take me down to the Actors Annex. There's an audition today.
You're going to audition for something?
Yeah, there's a Disney series regular opening up, and I'm going to go sweep it.
No, I absolutely refuse to let you audition for a Disney live-action show. You're way too young, and I don't want to be taking you to rehab next week.
Also, you heard you have to sleep with the executive producer, and he's nasty.
Hi, I'm Paul Dini.
I'm Misty Lee, and I gotta go, you guys. I'm working on a project for my agent, but I love you and have a good time.
Catching up after the Memorial Day weekend. It was one of those weekends when we decided, let's not do anything. You know, let's stay at home. Let's nest. Mm-hmm. Let's rest. Let's recover, recoup. Not that we really have anything to recover for. It's just nice to take a weekend where we go no place and see nobody and do nothing.
Sounds great.
Yes. So I had ordered a set of Harold Lloyd comedies that I was going to watch this weekend. Ooh. Old silent movies. I'm a huge silent movie fan. Sure. And I was all set to watch those. And I've never actually made it through entirely Safety Last, which is probably his best known comedy, certainly the best known image. That's when he scales the building in downtown Los Angeles and winds up dangling from the side of the clock.
Oh, yeah.
Harold Lloyd, if you don't know who I'm talking about, for people under 80 years old, he's a famous comedian of the silent film days. There was Chaplin, who was sort of the winsome immigrant tramp type character. Mm-hmm. There was Buster Keaton, who was a great stone face, who was sort of like this guy perennially at odds with the world. And he always greeted everything by this sort of blank expression, and he was, you know, a fantastic clown and acrobat because his training came from the circus. And then there was Harold Lloyd, who was a bit more of the all-American go-getter. And if you look at his personality, he seems to be this, you know, slim, fresh-faced young kid with big, huge, round black glasses and a straw hat and a snazzy little suit, and he's just going to go out and take on the world. And he's somebody who always gets frustrated in that, but always comes out ahead at the end. And for whatever reason, Lloyd's comedies are sort of viewed, they're a bit more obscure than Chaplin's or Keaton's. And even those guys, I'm sort of sorry to say, are falling a little farther and farther in the consciousness. So then you've got some other guys like Ben Turpin and Harry Langdon that next to nobody knows, and Fatty Arbuckle and guys like that. Laurel and Hardy are still pretty well known. Because
they made the translation of talkies.
They did. Mm-hmm. And Lloyd made the translation fairly smoothly. Mm-hmm. But when you get right down to it, once he started talking, he was just, suddenly you could just hear what he sounded like, and he didn't really sound all that different than you would imagine. And he was still just the kind of happy-go-lucky, sort of clueless go-getter, mm-hmm. you know? It would be like, if you were equating him to a Disney character, I guess he'd be like Horace Horsecollar or something, you know?
Yeah.
Certainly not a bad character, but he's not a goof-up like Goofy. He doesn't lose his temper like Donald. He's a little bit Mickey Mouse, but Mickey has more of a Chaplin to him, and Horace is just sort of like a good-natured, horsey guy who hangs out with Mickey and the others, and, you know, he doesn't really have an extreme. Harold Lloyd would, his thing, at least in silence, was he'd get into a scrape involving tremendous physical activity, like Buster Keaton, you know, where, and it would escalate, and some of the chases that he did were really fantastic. There's also a feature on the set I got called Girl Shy, which really is one of my favorite comedies, and that's my favorite Harold Lloyd comedy, because what's interesting about that, he plays a writer who stutters, and it's a silent comedy, and the whole gag is that he stutters, and he can't talk to women, and yet it's so deftly used within the feature that you buy it. You're never wondering why, you know, he uses that device very well, even though you never hear him do it. I'm sort of amazed the movie's never been remade, especially as a sound feature. The ending of that movie is incredible because he's given up on this girl that he's had his heart set on. He's, he, again, like, you know, in a lot of situations, he's humiliated, he's broken down, the girl is going to marry some, you know, snidely whiplash type ne'er-do-well, greasy city slicker. And then at the last minute, he finds out he really does love her, or she really does love him, he loves her. Success has been thundering at his door all the time. He's actually, you know, a big success and he didn't even know it. And then he's got to get from the sticks, which looks like somewhere out in like Agoura Hills or somewhere, you know, back when they shot this in 1925, it was probably all like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It just looks like, you know, someplace off in the boonies, and he has to get to downtown LA real quick. And every mode of transportation is used. And he always kind of comes up with a way to vary it. And just when you think he's got success, you know, it's like, like they're a little, like he's got to get to the city, got to get to the city. He sees a car outside of a service station with a big tire on the back, like a spare tire. Uh-huh. So he huddles in the spare tire on the back of the car, and the car takes off, and he's actually ad display four tires. you know, and then he's got to come up with something else. And he uses every device, and it just gets, you know, more and more funny and more hysterical. And Misty was watching one of the shorts, and she said, I can't watch it anymore. It makes me too nervous because, you know, everything blows up in this guy's face, and yet, and you know, is he going to make it? I'm too anxiety ridden. It makes me too nervous to think about what's going to happen to him.
It's like Ben Stiller movies to me, like the Meet the Fockers. Yeah. Something going to happen to him any minute now, and I just can't deal with it. Why is he getting in this?
Yeah, yeah. There's a movie that I was only able to sit through once, when I was much younger, I guess when this movie came out, I must have been about, I don't know, 13, 14, but I remember seeing it. It's called The Out of Towners, and it's about a couple that leaves their suburban home, like near Chicago or someplace, and goes to New York. Jack Lemmon.
Yeah.
And they go to...
they remade it with Steve Martin.
And Goldie Hawn, wasn't it?
Yeah, Goldie Hawn, yeah.
And John Cleese was in it.
Yes, yeah. I remember the girl in the original with Jack Lemmon.
I think it was Sandy Dennis.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And what happened was it's what I call like a nervous comedy or an angry comedy, because whatever happens, you know, something starts off bad and keeps getting bad and bad mm-hmm. and bad and bad and bad. And but with The Out of Towners, I just remember things got bad and they stayed bad. And you're just watching the world piss on this guy. And I think at the end of the movie, they fly home and then the plane gets hijacked or something like that. And it's like, there's no respite for this. Like, it's like taking a bug and just sort of grinding it till there's just nothing left. And it's not entertaining. It's just like an angry comedy. And I don't like those. I usually, you know, it's true. You know, as much as I hate sitting in a room and having an executive say, well, I don't know who to root for in this. People really do want to, you know, kind of root for somebody if you're watching a comedy and you kind of empathize at all with somebody, or at least you want to see the guy, you know, triumph a little bit. You get satisfaction knowing, like, I'm nothing like that dummy on screen, when it's like, maybe not exactly, but, you know, you can empathize enough with him because you've done enough stupid shit that you know, you can kind of, be in tune with that, but you're kind of like one step up on him. I think that's why people liked Laurel and Hardy originally, was because they acted like gentlemen, or they tried to, and their suits were just a little bit off, you know, and a little bit antiquated, and they, through their own usual bungling, they wound up, you know, screwing things up. You kind of loved them because they weren't aggressively awful like the Three Stooges. They weren't nasty to each other, even though they would kind of, Ollie would kind of get upset with Stan, but they would, you know, they'd bungle their way through, and you wouldn't feel bad if they wound up the loser, you know, in the comedy. I think Laurel was really kind of insistent that some of the shorts have sort of downer endings or bizarre endings, and so on the whole, they were, and those guys are still pretty famous and pretty well known. I don't know how many young, up and coming comedy fans seek out their stuff, but I think the action is such in those movies, and also with the Three Stooges, that when you talk about old-time comedies, I think Laurel and Hardy and the Three Stooges come up probably more than Chaplin or even the Marx Brothers or something like that. I was talking to a friend last night, a comedy writer, who works on a number of shows. Our good friend Eddie Gordetsky, and he was talking, you know, to some of the younger writers on some of the staffs he works on about, you know, old time comedy, mm-hmm. and you know how you should watch that. And then he says, yeah, and then you know, I'll show him a Marx Brothers movie, and about 5 minutes into it, I'm yawning. I'm bored.
Yeah, sure.
And so I think that sometimes, you know, when people talk glowingly about old time comedies, they're talking about a segment here, a segment there, or a mm-hmm. great exchange of here and there. Most of the Marx Brothers movies, the early ones certainly, I can watch with no problem. If Duck Soup is on, I'll watch it all the way through, no matter where I tune in. Horse Feathers, same thing. Monkey Business, which is probably my favorite just for sheer, you know, bizarre lunacy. I love that movie. Once you get to A Night at the Opera is more of a commitment because it's a longer movie and it's mm-hmm. got more of an involved plot. Horse Feathers, I've never actually managed to sit through an entire, enjoy an entire seating of it, you know, through it all the way through, because once they went to MGM, they started loading them down with music and subplots. And again, characters to root for who are not the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
In A Night at the Opera, Irving Thalberg, the producer, said, you know what, you should root for the Marx Brothers. He wanted to make Harpo more sympathetic, you know, mm-hmm. more of a kind of, you know, a little more of a Chaplin-esque character. And it kind of works in that movie. And then Thalberg died when they were making A Day at the Races. And then the Marx Brothers kind of fell in stature because he was the big supporter of them at MGM. And some of their later comedies are actually pretty crappy. They have moments. They're moments.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I'm not West. A big fan of Go West. Yeah.
Go West, the big story. Well, Go West is kind of a retread of Way Out West, the Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
Laurel and Hardy feature. And every moment of Way Out West is just genius. I think that's probably their best feature. That or Sons of the Desert are probably really good. Really good. I like Way Out West a little bit more because they're sort of off on their own, whereas Sons of the Desert, they're tied into the henpecked husband thing. Even though it's fun to see them in that role every once in a while, there's something about, you know, Way Out West that I just find is very, very appealing and very funny. That's another one I just watch whenever it's on. Watch that all the way through. But with the Marx Brothers, once you get...
I think Day at the Races was my last all-time favorite of theirs. Like, out of all of them, I just enjoy that one. They sort of went out with a bang, I guess, because they're just having fun, it felt like.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like it was too much. It's like Thunderball.
Yeah.
You know, like Thunderball is almost too much of a good thing for as far as James Bond movies go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like, it had gotten so big and the movie was so long. And the other thing is, like, when the climactic fight is underwater, shot in 1965, you know, there's no way to make that entertaining. It's slow, you know, you can't throw a punch underwater and have it mean anything. You know, they should have figured that out and then not done Moonraker, which is the same problem. But we were watching the one after it, which was You Only Live Twice the other night, and about a week ago. And the ending of that, that's just fun. That's James Bond in like a total fantasy movie. That's him almost in like an episode of The Thunderbirds or something. Once you have the secret base and the ninjas, there's something like, you know, we have a rocket inside a volcano. And it's sort of like, close blast shields. You know, close the windows, you know. And a rocket goes off and doesn't reduce everybody to cinders inside there. Blofeld just like turns the blinds.
Yeah.
And so the rocket takes off. It's like Wile E. Coyote putting up that little tiny umbrella when the cliff is going to fall on him. It's not going to work. And then the ninjas come through. All that movie needs is Godzilla, you know. Yeah, Godzilla with a giant Union Jack painted on his belly coming in. Oh, I'm going to help you, Bond. That would be a great ending to that movie.
That would be. Why haven't we gotten that crossover yet?
James Bond and Godzilla together in a movie. God, you know, we started off talking about it's like we've just, it's like stream of consciousness just rattling here. We've gone from silent movies to James Bond to Godzilla and everything like that.
Yeah, we veered off the road here.
I don't think we're ever on the road. That's I don't think we ever left the garage. I think, you know, the monoxide has taken us over and we're just rambling at this point. But anyway, So like we weren't going to do, getting back to Memorial Day, we weren't going to do much of anything. And then, somebody came over and they had a pilot episode that they had worked on of a new show. So we wound up having a few folks in. We watched that. It's really good.
Yeah, I always enjoy watching new pilots with some of the people who are involved. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's interesting because there was a room full of people who, some of whom had worked with this producer on one of his other shows, and so they got to, you know, see what he was doing apart from the show that he usually works on with that person to get those people together. Mm-hmm. And then there were just some interested folks, and there was people who had no connection to anything and were just offering opinions on it. So it was sort of like a good way to do a little on the spot, focus groups.
Yeah.
Focus grouping, which is what I'll do too. I'll have people over and you know, run something, just say, hey, you know, give a look at this, and then I'll have an episode of something just to see, you know, if they're excited about it, if it's interesting, if the story holds together, or you know, if the person's like looking around or gone out for a drink or something. It's like, oh, I don't think this is going to play too well. Actually, I saw it last week with an audience. Misty and I went over to the Warner Brothers lot, and they screened the Tom and Jerry direct-to-video that I wrote.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and I got to see it with the animators and with the production crew, mm-hmm. and they all dug it. I mean, they've been working on it for nearly 2 years, so they're probably sick to death of it, and they probably really enjoyed watching it. I really enjoy watching it on, I was going to say the Moviola, but I haven't looked at that in a year. Oh, God, I've got to get on the
night. Well, stuck in that silent movie for
or I'm stuck in the old Disney sweatbox days where they used to watch it on that, you know. I used to watch cartoons on that, way back in the 80s. You know, they still had that, all that when they would cut them in-house and everything. But now we watch them on, you know, I watch them on the computer. I get them directly from... They're like beamed from the animation house to the production company here, and then they give me a code, and I just watch it on my computer. Yeah. And there's the there'll be the animatic, which is a storyboard, and then I can even look at it when I want rough animation, and then the finished cut, and then everything. And
wow.
Or the rough cut is usually what I look at. That's when I give my notes for, like, well, this needs to be reshot, or we need some more dialogue here, or I'm lost. What happened? Why did the sequence get cut? That sort of thing. So, but when I first see the animation, and actually I remember about a year ago going over and watching some of the rough animation on Tom and Jerry and seeing some of the sequences, and I was just floored at how full the animation is on this one. Wow. And I think that's the one small upside in the fact that studios like Disney have cut loose a lot of their 2D animators is that there are a lot of just incredibly gifted artists who are now looking for work. You know, most of them are moved over into 3D or computer animation. Or at
least trying.
Or doing some other projects. But there are quite a lot of them that are available to work on some of these direct-to-videos. And the thing about Spike Brandt and Tony Cervone, who we've had on the podcast before, is they really like doing as much of that in-house as they can. It's almost like going back and like animating in your garage, because you get a bunch of guys together, and you know, a lot of guys, you know, will sort of work really hard just for love of the game, and they'll take a sequence and they'll add it and stuff, and animate it and just really spend a lot of time tweaking it, just more out of the fact that they, you know, they love what they're doing. And it was great watching it on a big screen at the lot, and in a nice screening room, and it played really well. You know, played really well. The animation looks great. The songs are, you know, came off pretty well. Some of the animated song sequences are really terrific. I mean, you know, it's they really knocked it out of the park with that one. It was sort of like a long-standing, you know, item on my bucket list, or at least in my to-do list for working in animation, is someday, like a dream assignment, is like write a Red Hot Riding Hood cartoon, or at least write her, you know, write a Red Hot Riding Hood song number in. And it's like, sure, I'll put that down. When am I going to do that? You know, and it's like there is one. It's a showpiece of the video. Actually, it comes at this really, you know, cool moment just where something like that is needed. And I thought, well, I've got Red in this playing. It's sort of, without telling too much, it's Tom and Jerry in the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, sort of. It has a different kind of beginning, and yet it sort of winds up in fairy tale land where they're with a boy with Jack, and they're, you know, helping him, you know, rescue the golden goose and the magic harp and everything. And what we did in the cartoon, and I'm going to have Spike and Tony on, you know, around August when they release it, so they can talk a little bit more about it, was that we recast a lot of the fairy tale roles with a lot of the MGM characters. So we kind of created a part for Red to play the good fairy of Fairyland, who's sort of like the peacekeeper of Fairytale Land. And in order to distract the giant, she sings this little torch number. And the animation on it is really just terrific. I don't think we'll ever be able to recapture exactly what Preston Blair did in Swing Shift Cinderella, or Red Hot Riding Hood, or you know, one of the ones that he animated back in the 40s, because he was basically the only animator who was allowed to touch Red. You know, those were all his sequences when he did all the dancing girl numbers. But this one gives it a pretty good run for the money, and it's very, and what I was really impressed with, and one of the things I've talked to Spike and Tony about, and I keep mentioning, is the timing in those sequences is so important to do, you know, when everything seems to just mix seamlessly. Like in Aladdin, you've got the Friend Like Me cartoon segment, you know, where the genie explains, you know, what he does, you know, to Aladdin. And that's one of the things that Disney does best, is when they've got, you know, they'll always do a romantic ballad or the love song or something, but where Disney, you know, knocks it out of the park is when they've got a magical character who explains what they do by using magic or through means of sort of breaking away from the reality of what the picture is. So we did that in our own humble way in the Tom and Jerry thing, where Red, who plays the good fairy, is magically kind of transforming and doing things. And and at the same time, she's also telling Tom and Jerry, like, over here, do this, do that, everything else. And the timing is really great as they're trying to set up, you know, something to pull on the giant, who's, you know, kind of like watching, like the wolf, you know, Red do her number. But and so the fact that we were able to at least attempt that and pull it off, you know, in a way, was you know, to me, very, very, very satisfying.
I can imagine. Those are classic cartoons that, everyone grew up with watching.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like, in some ways, it's more complex because when they made those cartoons, it would be like Red would be dancing and Preston Blair would draw her singing and dancing. And then somebody like Ed Love would be drawing, would be animating the wolf, you know, and his reaction. He'd have the fun stuff like the wolf taking himself by the neck and smashing his head on the table, or or biting a you know, a pillar, or eating plates or something like that. You know, there are so many gags they did in those sequences, and they're all terrific. And so, you know, the fact that we could kind of do that was a lot of fun. Those are some of my favorite cartoons. And nowadays, you know, you see like people scream at those, like, "Oh, they're sexist! Look at the wolf; he's drooling all over that girl." It's like, no, he's not. He never even touches her because she's smart enough to stay away from him, and she's usually the one that clobbers him. You know?
Yeah, they usually show that that kind of character is not good.
I know. Now all the I haven't seen this cartoon. But all the the right wingers and the
teabaggers.
It was an article on Breitbart, actually. They were up in arms against a new cartoon called Shi Zhao, and Shi Zhao was a cartoon I knew was in development about 2 or 3 years ago, and the people pitching it had pitched it over and over. Originally, it was called Shazam, and the premise is, it's the first transgender superhero. And it's kind of a funny idea. It's about a boy who, it's about a brother and sister who are going through their grandmother's house or their aunt's house, and they find a vault. And inside, they find like the magic ring of a superheroine who existed years before called Shi Zhao, who's like Wonder Woman. And whoever puts on the ring gets the power. But the boy doesn't realize that until he puts the ring on. And the sister loves Shi Zhao, but then the ring gets on the boy and he can't take it off or something like that. So what happens is he's super powerful, but he has to be a girl, you know, or, and they changed the artwork a little bit. So now it looks more like a boy dressed up like a girl, but whereas originally it was like a boy Maybe they do the same thing, because when I looked at it, it was called Shazam, and it was over at Disney. Mm-hmm. And I think they dropped it, and then it was taken over to the Hub, which is where this is airing. And I, you know, of course you'd have to change the title, because Shazam is basically Shazam.
Yeah.
And no way you're going to win an argument with DC's lawyers over that.
Yeah, they already went through enough trying to get that.
Yeah, I know. They killed Shazam originally.
Yeah.
In the 50s, and then they brought it back because they had robbed themselves inadvertently of Captain Marvel. And mm-hmm. so you come out with a character called Shazam, you get the joke, but yeah. on the other hand, you know, it's the same thing. But now apparently people are saying, it's a transgender character and it's going to corrupt our kids and everything. It's like, have you ever seen British comedy?
Yeah.
Exactly. It's all guys running around in dresses. I mean, come on. I mean, how uptight and repressed have we become that this is even an issue? The idea yeah. of a boy who, a boy's boy who has to, I'm only powerful when I'm a girl. It's not a bad lesson. I mean, it's like, okay, it's sort of fun, yeah. Good. It's creative. I haven't seen it before. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
But I just want to say to them, have you ever seen Monty Python? Have you ever, watched this? Don't be afraid of shit like that.
There's
man.
Even a Japanese manga where the boy turns into a girl.
Oh, that's half of Japanese yeah. manga anyway. That's all anime.
Yeah,
it's like
exactly.
It's all.
But the kids are reading that out here. Rama 1/2. I guarantee
yeah,
you, every kid
that.
Has read that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's like, have you ever read manga? It's only. It's like Ranma. Was it Ranma? Ranma 1/2. Yeah. When he gets wet, he turns into a girl, and uh-huh. When he gets dry, he's a boy. But the only time he's powerful is when he's the girl. You know. And so that's a given from Japanese comics. It's all boys turning into girls and girls turning into boys and all that stuff. It's like, and I don't see they have an issue with it. It's like with any of the stuff in Japan, even the giant robots or some of the bloodier ninja stuff and everything, the idea is like, oh yes, it's a comic book. It doesn't really happen. I'm able to read it and I put it away and then I go on with my life. Mm. And I don't have half the problems that America seems to have. It's fantasy.
We can tell the difference.
Yeah. It's not, it's like, okay, it's schoolgirls and it's guns and it's robots and it's this and it's that. But, it's fantasy. And in some ways, it's not bad fantasy, too. What do you have in America? It's girls dreaming of being princesses. Mm-hmm. That's a hell of a lesson for kids of a free society where we were taught to overthrow imperialist rulers and royalty and everything. We've now suddenly every girl dream or little girls are like, I want to be a princess. I want to be a princess. Oh yeah. Well, what do you know about, government and managing, a national budget and warfare and stuff. You want to be a princess? Sure. Okay. We'll marry you off to a guy you've never seen in another country to ensure a treaty. And, then you can go live off in his house and be miserable. Be prince, you just want the dress and the crown, come on.
Back to the screen, do you get a chance to watch many of your projects screened in front of an audience like that?
Sometimes I work very sporadically for Warner Brothers these days, so mm-hmm. when they have a screening, it's very nice they invite me to something like yeah. that. It's like Spike and Tony are really a class act that they would do that. And actually, here's a bit of an announcement. We're actually trying to, and it looks like we don't have a lock on it, but it's looking pretty good. Like we will be showing Tom and Jerry at Comic-Con.
That's right.
So I'll be doing a panel with Spike and Tony at some point at Comic-Con, and we'll be running the Tom and Jerry's Giant Adventure. So, it's not official, so hopefully I'm not jinxing it by getting it out there. But once we get closer to Comic-Con, which is only about 6 weeks away, then I'll make an official announcement about that, when it's going to be, or if it's going to be, mm-hmm. and what other panels I'm going to be doing. I will probably do more than likely, 99%. As I'm a guest this year, I'll be doing a panel, spotlight panel where I'm talking about what I'm working about and my job and everything. And that I just look upon as a Q&A for the audience. So mm-hmm. whatever anybody wants to ask me about Arkham or the Hulk or everything, hopefully I have some amusing stories to tell. and just do a Q&A with the audience for a while. And then Mark Evanier asked me the other night if I would be on his Pogo panel, because it's the 100th anniversary of Walt Kelly's birth.
Fantastic.
So I'm really psyched about doing that. So there's going to be some, I think there's going to be some really interesting folks on that panel, and I'm sure I'll, you know, go for an hour and talk about Pogo anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. It's not hard for you.
No, it's not hard. It's the greatest.
Yeah.
So and then we're working on Tom and Jerry, maybe one or two other, you know, other things I'm going to be doing there. So
very nice.
Yeah.
I actually recently got a chance to see one of my projects screened for the
first time. What was it?
It was a short film called Meter Man of Le Mouchachon.
Uh huh.
And it was screened over at the Paramount Studios.
Oh really?
Yeah,
oh great.
A lot of fun. Yeah.
Over on Melrose, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the most luxurious theater I've ever been in.
What was it like?
Oh, the seats are just so comfortable and plush. I could watch any movie there, no problem.
Paramount, right?
Yeah, it's their main screening room.
Oh yeah. I do know that one. Yeah.
The big circular one. That's yeah.
We saw Cloverfield there.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I got to watch my film along with four other short films there, and they're all really good.
Great.
And it's amazing seeing people laugh at jokes that you've understood and laughed at and helped create.
Yeah.
And then actually get to see the response. You're like, oh, people are laughing. Good. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just such a delight.
It is good. And when I went to see the thing over in the Warner's lot, I was going like, oh, is this joke going to play? Is this joke going to play? And it's like, nobody really laughed. I mean, they laughed at a few places, but the thing is, like, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Everybody wants to go home, and these are guys who've worked on this for the past 2 years. They know every dang joke.
Okay.
So that's why I want to see it at Comic-Con with kids and parents and animation fans. And
that would be amazing.
Yeah, the kids will dig it. The parents hopefully will stay awake through it, and the animation fans will, you know, they'll be sitting there going like, "Ooh, it stinks," but you know, hopefully one or two. We'll enjoy it, or at least have the class to, you know, not mock me there, but just throw something at me after I get out or something. I don't know. Whatever. You ruined Tom and Jerry for us. It's like, you can't ruin Tom and Jerry.
No,
you can't ruin Tom and Jerry. It's a cat with a skillet and a mouse with a lead pipe, and you just let them go at each other.
And everyone has different tastes. I mean, people say that Gene Deitch ruined Tom and Jerry, and I love those, so it's, you know, it's whatever.
Gene Deitch is going to be there.
Really?
At the convention. Mark's doing a panel on him.
Oh, my God. I got to go to that panel. I need to tell him how much he's influenced my career.
Tom Terrific?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And just the sound effects in his cartoons were always something that stuck with me.
Yeah. Gene Deitch, Tom and Jerry, Dickie Moe.
Yeah, Dickie Moe.
Oh, actually, shoot. Oh, damn it. I Moby Dick is actually in... In my script, in that one, yeah, because he's one of the storybook characters. I should have called him Dickie Moe. Oh God,
that's a lost opportunity.
Dickie Moe.
Oh man.
Oh God. Oh darn it. I was too literal. I made him Moby Dick. He should have been Dickie Moe.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been a little too meta. That would have been a little too inside.
Oh, no, I don't know. I think you would have had that one group of fans that are just worshiping you for it.
I would have had one fan. I would have had one guy knowing Tom Minton. Dickie Moe. Real funny. Awful cartoon. Dickie Moe. Yeah, pretty good. Yeah. Where's Cool Cat? It's not a really good cartoon unless you sit Cool Cat in there somewhere. I'm Tweety Sylvester Mysteries. We put in Cool Cat all the time. It's like he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, poor Cool Cat. There. Never had a good cartoon. Mm-mm. Well, his design was terrible. It was a ripoff of both Snagglepuss and the Pink Panther and everything. And I remember as a kid being kind of excited about those characters. Like, they had been played up in comic books, or I had seen, you know, the weird thing is, like, I started watching cartoons at the ass end of theatrical releases.
Oh, you know,
like the last few years, where they had actual theatrical cartoons on the program when they were still making them. They went up to like 1970, I think. And that was right around the time I could take myself to the movies. I couldn't drive, but I'd have to walk. And I'd walk about a mile into town, and then there would be, like, I'd see matinees on the weekend. And they still had, you know, we're getting new cartoons in. This is great. I can watch Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah.
I can watch, you know, Scooby-Doo and the Archies on Saturday morning and Wacky Races and walk to the movie theater. There'll be a brand new cartoon.
Wow.
And then it was stuff like Cool Cat. Or really, really awful Woody Woodpeckers. Or Pink Panthers that just made no sense. So it was like, oh.
Yeah, some of those later Pink Panthers were really weird.
Yeah. Pink Panthers and the Tijuana Toads and things like
that. Idea of things. They're just like, ah, do whatever sticks to the wall, see?
Yeah, yeah. And like, Frizz was running out of ideas at that point. Yeah. I think he'd long run out of ideas. But the last of the Seven Arts Warner Brothers cartoons were around 68, 69. And and they did, I think what happened was, I might have seen them a little later than that, but our theater would get them or they would reshow them and stuff like that. And then once it got later into the 70s, they always ran cartoons, but they would mix it up. Like, here's this new crappy looking Woody Woodpecker cartoon. But next week they're showing an old Pluto cartoon. So, come and watch that. And I would actually ask the guy at the box office, what cartoon are you running? I think it's a Mickey Mouse short next week. Really? Which one? I haven't seen it, but it's called Mr. Mouse Takes a Trip. And I'm like, maybe get stoned in that one. I don't know. I haven't heard of that one. So we're on home.
I can't imagine, I wonder what Mickey's going to be up to this week. Because when I was around those cartoons, they were all already played.
They're on TV
you're just seeing reruns I just haven't caught this one, but I've seen it referenced or something.
Well, you know, the thing with old cartoons was that the Disney company at that point was real stingy with their cartoons. And they only had one program on TV, and that was The Wonderful World of Disney, you know? And they would only run cartoons very sporadically on that show. Usually it was like the raccoon who wanted to be a certified public accountant.
It's great because those names aren't far off.
You're not liable to find many raccoons in your basic office park, but old Ringo was an exception, you know. And then, you know,
the tattooed police horse.
The
cougar thought he was a dog.
The cougar thought he was a dog. Or they do some weird thing about a frontier family, you know.
Yeah.
Like the Bradleys of Boomtown, you know. And go like, you know, come back next week for part 3 of 8 of the Bradleys of Boomtown. Oh, I'm not watching
that. I saw one recently that was about a grandfather who's a detective. And his kids helped him solve this crime, and it was made by Wes Craven.
For the
Disney Walt Disney Wonderful World of
Disney.
Yeah, wow. Wes Craven directed. It was like right after one of his failing movies, in that loose time of his career.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Everybody started off somewhere. You know, Richard Donner started doing. You know, he began. He started off doing the banana splits.
Oh, wow.
Not the banana splits themselves, but they had a serial called Danger Island, and he directed that.
That was, really?
Yeah, yeah, the Danger Island segment. He directed that, yeah. Walt Disney's Wonderful World of... The Wonderful World of Disney, it was like... It would be like, Gallagher, boy detective. You know, he's the young go-getter reporter in 1908, you know, in New York. And it's like 7 parts to the serial. Gallagher's always in trouble. The boy with a nose for news. Live action, crappy shots, or some western that would go on forever. You know, Wagon Trains West. Next week in part 3 of Wagon Trains West. Oh no,
they go further west.
Yeah, they go further west. I hope we make Topeka by August before the snow sets in. And then, just awful. And then next week, you know. Donald Duck at home. Oh, thank God, a cartoon. Woo. Thank God, a cartoon. And I'd wait all week to watch it. You know, everybody shut up. Because they just like chop up old Donald Duck cartoons.
That was what I was going to say. Most of them were just clips or like themed shows or something.
Yeah, and it was 4 minutes of new footage. Mm-hmm. And they'd always shoot Donald, you know, like Donald would be screaming, you know, over here. And then they would record some new dialogue. And then they would just, you know, flip the animation and scream over here. And it was real cheap, you know. And sometimes they'd actually throw you, because it's Disney, they would really slip you the sausage, and they'd really it's like, next week a cartoon, Ludwig von Drake, okay, explains architecture. Oh. And then it'll be like a whole thing of an hour of him just like, and this is a Doric column, don't you know, and this is this is ionic, you know, over here, which is ironic, which is something, a word, I don't know, I'm just making this stuff up. And it would be like Paul Frees just rattling on for an hour and, again, yeah. reuse animation and nothing fun is happening. So they're giving you a cartoon, and yet it's about something really boring.
Now, did you have to watch any of those Disney, like, safety educational films in school? Or was that just after you? Because my generation had a lot of those.
We had those. Those were animated like in the 50s and 60s. Yeah, yeah. So we would have gotten
but
those.
But I don't know if they actually played them in schools or not.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember we would see like how to have an accident at work.
Yeah.
How to have an accident at home.
Uh-huh.
They actually showed a symposium on popular songs with Ludwig von Drake, which is awful, which goes on for freaking ever. And, you know, cutout animation, which is sort of good. But there's something about Von Drake is like, I like the design and I like the idea of the character.
He seems fascinating.
But he just comes out and talks. I'm going to rat it on for a while in my Austrian accent. And what am I doing over here? Oh, look, there's a bug. Hello, Herman, the bug. How are you? You know, it's like, oh, just do something funny. You know, just stick your hand in a light socket or something. Just blow up or something, you know. Or bring Donald in, you know, at least someone to talk to. Then I remember, I didn't see this in the school. But I think I saw it on TV or something. Or I wanted to go to the theater so badly and see this. It was like 1960. It was like within months after Walt Disney died. It was like early winter. It was like late winter of 1967. It was like they came out with an Uncle Scrooge cartoon. And I'm going, oh, it's an Uncle Scrooge cartoon. It's the last thing Walt Disney did. And it was Uncle Scrooge and Money. And I remember seeing it. It still had Walt Disney Presents. Like this is the cartoon he made before he died. And I love Uncle Scrooge. And the cartoon is like, the
capital gains tax.
That's what it is. That's exactly what it is. Huey, Dewey, and Louie take the, you know, it's like, there's the money vault. I'm with you. You know, Huey, Dewey, and Louie with their piggy bank. I'm with you so far. There's Uncle Scrooge and the money and the treasure vault. Oh, great. They're gonna bring some money and they're going to go off on an adventure. They're going to discover the golden idol of the Incas, or they're going to go to the seven cities of Cibola or something.
Or
it's
they
like
need to defend it from the Beagle Boys.
Yeah, the Beagle Boys are coming. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Magic and a spell. Oh, boy. Yeah. Something really great is going to happen. Uncle Scrooge, we have $1.95. Ah, boys, let me tell you how to invest that. Well, you put your money in the bank and you watch it grow, and then we have animated money and we've got 20 more minutes of this. And it's like, what? And then it's like, well, boys, it all began long ago when cavemen were trading for spears and tiger skins. They really were the Beagle Boys. It's like on and on it goes. And it's like, and it's about this awful moment about 9 minutes in, I realize I'm watching a lesson, and the Beagle Boys just ain't going to show up. They're not going anywhere. They're not going to get on a plane.
No, they're never.
They're not going to go see the Menahunies. They're not going to see the Abominable Snowman. Gladstone Gander's not showing up. They're not going to have any fun at all. All Scrooge is going to do is take their $1.98 or whatever it is they had and invest it for them, and that's it.
And they're not even going to get to spend it.
You
gotta save it.
Yeah, it's not even like, what would be great is like, we have money, we're going down the street to get a chocolate soda, and Scrooge just tackles him. No, boys, no. Who's this creepy old duck? I'm your Uncle Scrooge, and I'll tell you I don't invest that money. Meanwhile, we're gonna blow up some Beagle Boys who are, you know, trying to rip you off. That would have been fun if they had to dodge a few Beagle Boys on their way to the treasure vault.
Missed opportunities.
Well, you know, I always heard something, and I guess it's true, is like, they tried developing Scrooge as a cartoon, as a standalone cartoon character in the 50s because almost from his inception, he was a very popular character. Mm-hmm. And the comic books sold extremely well. And they tried developing him, you know, or at least introducing him in the Donald Duck comic animated shorts as a foil for Donald. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is why if you watch the original opening of the Mickey Mouse Club, Scrooge is in the opening. You know, he's got a very brief cameo in like the three little pigs are pulling in the big bad wolf, and the top of the big bad wolf's top hat opens up and Scrooge pops out, and then like another character pops out of his hat. So he is in there, you know, just real briefly. And so what happened was the story men they had on the shorts at that time, and we're thinking like mid to late 50s, that they weren't really their most inspired crew. and the directors were, you know, they'd been doing the same stuff for a long time. So, you know, these were guys who were really just, you know, no offense intended, but they were just straight rank and file gag men, you know? And if it came to doing characters with a bit of business, they were pretty good at figuring that out. So that's why the cartoons, the Donald Duck cartoons around that time, it's Donald versus a little bee, or Chip and Dale, mm-hmm. or, you know, Humphrey the Bear was even kind of a step up. Yeah. Because Humphrey was like a big adversary, and he is in and of himself funny. But mostly it was like Chip or Dale or bugs or insects that Donald was kind of like, uh-oh, here's where I have some fun. And he'd torment a bug, and then the bug would come back, and then, you know, he'd just drive Donald to distraction. And, you know, Donald would wind up the loser in this cartoons. You know, the real loser, of course, being the audience that wanted some entertainment, but just seeing, you know, Donald got beaten up by a bee again. Oh, boy, that's 7 minutes well spent. And you know, so Scrooge came along, and Carl Barks was a really terrific writer.
Yeah.
And the story guys looked at the comics in the animation, and they go, I don't see what's funny about a rich old duck who sleeps in money. Where's the gags? Where's the fun? Where's the animation that we can do in that? You know, Donald...
It's based around the action. It's based around their adventures.
Well, that's the thing. It's based... Well, it's also based around Donald having to talk to him.
Yeah.
And Donald, you know, hence that's why they put Launchpad in DuckTales, and mm-hmm. Donald was only a minor player at best. But it's like they kept saying, well, how do we have... I mean, they did a cartoon where Donald is going hunting and the spirit of his grandfather is taking him hunting, and that's more of a hunting gag cartoon. I mean, even Donald's a lesser character in that. So I think they were kind of looking like, how do we introduce Scrooge as sort of a character like that? Or, you know, what can we do with him? You know, how is he funny? And it's like, it really is hard when you've been basing cartoons around Donald's a big guy who's a bully, Chip and Dale are small, so they get the better of him, you know? Mm-hmm. Or it's those things. Or if we put Donald against Pete, who's a big guy, and Donald can win out because he's the little guy who has to beat up, he has to beat up a bully. You know, Scrooge really depends on good writing, you know? Like, so they go off on an adventure, or they, you know, the Beagle Boys or something like that. If they had done a cartoon, you know, just... Scrooge says, you know, I could see them bringing in Scrooge as a guy who's always employing Donald, and Donald, you know, screws up, you know, because that gives them something physical to do. But if mm-hmm. they had done a cartoon where Scrooge says, well, I'm your rich uncle and you need to guard my vault because I'm going out for the night and make sure the Beagle Boys don't get in, then you have Donald, you know, fighting the Beagle Boys, and suddenly the Beagle Boys can take over and they can do all the talking in the picture, and they're trying to get in. But they, whatever, for whatever reason, they never cracked anything like that with Donald, because I think they were just in the mindset of Donald either is a bully or else he's bullied by somebody bigger, and you know, and that was sort of it.
And Uncle Scrooge was wayside to like just this visiting character.
Yeah, because I don't think they ever could crack him and figure out what was interesting about him within a 7 minute cartoon, you know. And looking at from the point of view of the story men and the director at that time, they weren't wrong, you know. In order to develop the character, I think Walt would have had to have taken a personal hand, or else kind of moved the Donald cartoons over to somebody else, or at least said, brought in another team and said, okay, we're going to do cartoons about this rich old duck who doesn't think Donald's going to amount to anything, and he's got to kick his ass to make him perform. So make the make your relationship about that. Make Scrooge the bully. Make Scrooge the guy who's saying to Donald, you got to get a job and prove yourself. And then Donald, you know, will either succeed at the job or fuck up or mm-hmm. something like that. But there has to be something, you know, you have to look at for 7 minutes. You can't do the Seven Cities of Cibola in 7 minutes. You know, that's like an epic, you know. You could do it in a feature. But, you know, again, even with features, they never really thought about Donald as being a character who could really carry a feature. You know, a supporting character with Mickey and Goofy, or, you know, in segments of features. But, and I know they tried back, you know, Barks tried actually back in the 30s before he went off into the comics. They did they tried doing a Donald treasure hunting cartoon. But,
oh, really?
Jack Hanna and Carl Barks came up with something, which they later turned into a comic book. Them trying to, you know, go on a treasure hunt. I think the idea of Donald on a treasure hunt, or Mickey, Donald, and Goofy on a treasure hunt, is something that throughout the Disney history, like 90 years of that studio, they've tried, you know, resurrecting it various times, and they've just mm-hmm. never been able to figure out a way to do it. Or,
in fact, I think the DuckTales movie that they did after the series was like a treasure hunt movie.
Yeah, in a way, a weird way, it was sort of a forerunner of Aladdin, where they get the genie of the lamp, and the genie wants to be a regular guy, and at the end they free the genie, and they did the same thing in Aladdin when that came out. And actually, Aladdin came out after that.
So yeah.
They had sort of borrowed from that, or, you know, figured out, well, what else can we do with the genie? You know, he wants to be set free, so, you know, that's sort of the decent thing to do with a genie. You know, make one wish for yourself, and, you know, help out somebody else, and then let the genie go free or something. There are rules to genies, apparently.
Yes. Strict ones.
Well, it's sort of been established that if you use all three wishes for yourself, whatever, either...
It shows selfish.
Yeah, your first wish is bad. Your second wish is worse. Mm-hmm. And then you have to use the third wish to cancel out all the other wishes and reset things. Or else... You use your three wishes in a really terrible way, and then you just wind up screwed at the end when the genie vanishes. So I think, you know, the proper thing is, you know, if you have the three wishes, you might say something like, I want to make sure I get my second wish the exact way I want it. Let's make the second wish for what you really want and that it's delivered the way you want it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you're happy with that. And then the third wish is just sort of, you know, send the genie, you know, if the genie wants to be freed, you know, but just, you know, make sure, like, I'll set you free if you don't kill me out of spite on the spot, you know, and
that just be,
seek revenge on me.
In the small clause there.
you know, dealing with, you know, creatures of the unseen world, you know, is always difficult. You know, you always wind up in something like that. I was actually talking to somebody about that today. My dentist, I went to the dentist today, and we were talking about show business, and we were talking about, like kids who wind up like on Disney shows, for instance.
Yeah.
It's almost like the devil and Daniel Webster. It's like, like making a deal with the devil. You know, when you get involved in show business in that way, it's and the devil is very specific in the devil and Daniel Webster, especially in the movie version. I'm quoting here specifically. He says, "I'll give you money and all, everything money can buy." And later on, when the farmer who sold his soul says, you know, where are my friends? Why doesn't nobody love me? He goes, I never promised you that. I just promised you money. You know, I promised everything money can buy. You know, it's like it was very specific.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's interesting to watch these kids who have, at a very early age, you know, you look back on them, you know, in the 90s or the, you know, early 2000s when they were... when they were on these shows, you know, these shows on these kid networks, you know, fresh little scrub faces, some of whom were probably in PSA saying, you know what, only a loser does drugs, you know,
yes.
And things like that. You know, they're just off doing these things and people are making money off them. And then, you know, it's like once they they're out of show business for a while, you know, what becomes of them, you know?
Well, from what the rumors that I understand going on about it is, it's they're under this pressure to be these perfect Disney models and, you know, and idols to kids and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So once they finally break free from that and get their own movie career, they start doing the independence films, they start experimenting drugs, they start going and partying, do alcohol, whatever, because they don't have the Disney mouse looking over their shoulder anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the rumors I hear. None of it has ever been backed up.
Well, I don't know. You know, I thought it was very interesting about the movie Spring Breakers, which seems to be like, there were, you know, there were a number of kids in that who were in Disney, the Disney things, and they're playing like, you know, Sluts Gone Wild, basically.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of outrageous.
But then again, you look at these, you know, actors, and they do wind up on drugs, and they do wind up, you know, kind of strung out or, you know, chain smoking, alcoholic, and you know, what was cute and fresh-faced at 17, 18, you know, 28 is like, where did I wake up this morning?
Yeah.
Where I'm in Pittsburgh. How the fuck did I get here?
Yeah, I remember watching Parent Trap back in the day going, this Lindsay Lohan is going to crash and burn.
Yeah.
You could tell right then that she's just too cute for her own good, and she's getting her way too often.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the thing. And I think a lot of it is, the kids are pushed from an early age into the public spotlight. The parent tries to manage them as best they can.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get to a point where, you know, people latch onto them. Either it's a manager who pushes them too hard or the sleazy boyfriend, you know, grabs onto some girl, you know, and, you know, starts getting them hooked on drugs and sort of, there was one case I saw years ago, you know, this is way going back, where there was a girl who was on a sitcom, and the sleazy boyfriend who kind of worked, you know, on the set, you know, I don't know for a fact if he was sleazy, but, you know, I saw him from time to time because a friend of mine was working on the show. Mm-hmm. And the guy didn't look like he was any sort of, you know, great guy, but it was sort of like, I'll get my hooks into her and then sort of ride her, you know, when she gets, you know, leaves the show and becomes a big star and everything. And none of that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, she didn't become a big star or anything. And then it always ends in divorce, and then there's a kid or two along the way, you know, and then, but now you're looking at these, specifically girls, you know, I just think it's harder on them, you know, mm-hmm. they're just going around and they have to, Lindsay Lohan was quoted as saying, look, I function better in a lot of confusion. I can't function without the confusion, you know, like, it's almost like she has to, like, force herself to rise above it in order to go out there and act and be creative and, mm-hmm. and everything. And it's just like they wind up becoming kind of hagged out at, you know, 26, 27.
Yeah, they look 40.
Uh-huh. And they become anorexic, and, you know, they smoke and drink too much, and then they just sort of wind up unpleasant people. And then there's Nickelodeon and Disney, and it's like, hey, come over here. You can be Tinkerbell. You can be a princess. You can have the whole world at your feet. Come on over. Just sign your name right here on the dotted line. And then, you know, somebody like Miley Cyrus, for instance, mm-hmm. I don't think is ever really going to run out of money, because I think that her dad was doing okay, even though he wasn't like a major chart topper at the time.
But he seemed to do well enough for himself.
Uh huh. Yeah. And he was on the show too. Yeah. And so I think she's enough of an industry in and of herself, sort of like the Olsen twins, mm-hmm. that she's going to kind of endure for years. But for some of these other girls, like it was Amanda Bynes, you know, that I was really kind of shocked to hear about her, because
she seemed to have her head on straight compared to most of them.
Yeah. And I'm wondering now, is she doing a career spin out, or is this a savvy career move? Is she, you know, or is this a publicity thing? Is she sort of sitting there going like, well, I seem to have cooled off a little bit. Lindsay Lohan is just like screaming off the deep end. Maybe I can kind of do a little bit of that.
And she is. She does have that sense of humor, so she might think it would just be funny.
Yeah, maybe she's doing like a Joaquin Phoenix or something like that. Yeah. I don't know. A very good friend of mine wrote a movie that she was in, and had a very good experience with her doing the movie, and then they were hoping to do another couple of movies, but it just didn't happen. And that was about 7-8 years ago. So I don't know, it's people just drop off the radar. They're so, sometimes celebrities are so in your face and they're everywhere, and then just 2 or 3 years out of the spotlight, or, you know, whatever, and then they just vanish, and then they try and come back, and there's just somebody just like them in their place who's on the rise. So you know, it's sad, but on the other hand, oh well. Too bad. I mean, what point can you care about that? You just sort of watch it happen, and you know, and just sort of shake your head. It's sort of like an inevitability of show business. Well, these things will happen, and stuff. But yeah, I don't know. If Misty and I had a kid, and he or she really wanted to be an actor, it would be like, well, okay, you can be an actor, but you're going to go to school, and you're going to do performances at school, and then you can do scene study at school, and then when you go to college, because you will be going to college, then you can, you know, go for your drama club, but forget about, you know, being on a Disney show, forget about, you know, being, you know, an 11-year-old, you know, wisecracking kid on a sitcom. Absolutely not going to happen. You know, just signing the kid's life over to somebody else. And I think
you'd rather give them the tools so they can keep working and acting throughout their life.
Yeah. And you know, and ultimately the other thing, not only acting throughout their life, but the thing I don't think a lot of kids understand, or even people who get involved with show business, is it is a business. Mm-hmm. And the more you know how to do, the better better off you are. So if you're going to school and you have a music program at your school, if all the funding hasn't been cut, you know, by all means, take an instrument, you know, take guitar or piano or something, mm-hmm. so that you know how to do that, or you know how to sing, or you know how to move, or you know how to dance or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then not only then not only do we have that in your pocket, but also you learn how to act and also learn how to write also. So you can write some of your own material that you may find, rather than just being out, going out at 12 and being a kid who says the wacky catchphrase on the Disney show, you know, playing second banana to some future alcoholic. You're and then because by the time, you know, the show runs through for 3 years, and then it's like, I'm 15, what's my next job? Well, you never, you know, because everybody knows you as goofy, you know, brother Jake on this show, and nobody wants to see goofy brother Jake anymore. So goodbye. And it's like, but I can do more than goofy brother Jake, you know. No. But so that's why if you want to get into show business, learn how to do other things. So just be goofy brother Jake, learn how to sing and dance and act and stuff like that. Coming from long years of bitter experience.
Back in the day, all the actors need to be able to act and sing and dance and all that stuff. They need to have all those talents.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's such an incredible demand for content now that, you know, it's amazing that when you see people who have actually had some career longevity, when they've been able to kind of surf the wave and they've had a long career. Somebody like Seth Green, for instance, seems to have his head really, you know, set on his shoulders. Or somebody who really knows what he wants to do, or has, you know, the first time I was ever aware of him was in the movie Radio Days, and I guess he was 11 or 12 when he played young Woody Allen in that movie, and then I thought he was really funny in the movie, and then he would show up occasionally as when he moved into his teen years. He seemed to be like kind of like a teen star, and then he was in the
Buffy
and the Austin Powers movies.
Oh yeah, Powers. Yeah, that put him on the map.
Yeah, and then a couple of other movies here and there, and then he'd be on these TV shows and everything, and then he's produced now. You know, I work with him on Hulks and the Agents of Smash. Really nice guy, and he's doing Robot Chicken and everything. Mm-hmm. That is a guy who really is very savvy as far as somebody who, you know, okay, started off as a kid actor, but then, you know, he was also kind of a geek also, and really, you know, a consummate fanboy, and he sort of wanted to find out, okay, not only do I act and I'm a funny guy, but how do I also maximize my love for comics and cartoons and have a career doing that? So, you know. So now he's off producing, you know, his own shows, and now he's starring in the new Seth MacFarlane sitcom and everything like that that's coming out later this year. So there's a guy who was very savvy and did it right, you know, I think. And so, but also, you know, I don't know him well, but we hang out during some of the recording sessions. He just seems to be a guy who really knows what he wants and is you know. Once you have a clear vision of what you want, and you figure out pretty quickly, you know, how I'm going to get it, and you're almost always going to be successful. So that's probably the one child star I know who it kind of worked out well for. In short, that's my feelings about child stars. And Super Rica,
see,
what do you? That's beautiful. I didn't know you could play the guitar.
Oh, yes, I've been practicing. There's a big audition down at Disney for little boys who can sing and...
That's enough. Give me the guitar.
You're standing in my way of stardom.
No, go to your room.
Hey, I'm finally finished with my project. I'm all done.
How'd it turn out?
It turned out okay.
Great. I saw you in the back filming yourself. You were doing monster screeches. And,
yeah, I was creeping around.
And voices and everything. Yeah. Can we talk about what that's for?
Nope.
Okay, that'll be for a future podcast.
Yeah, so I'm done. I can come on in and start chatting.
Well, it'd be great, except we're at just over 60 minutes, so I think we're done for this
week. Oh, you're done too?
Yeah.
All right, well, then I will see you all next week. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye. You know what? There's I got to leave, too. There's an audition down at Disney for guys to play old frumps and stooges to wisecracking kids.
Oh, no way. No way. I don't want to take you to rehab.
What's that, Hobart? Oh, they're auditioning exotic animals for a new Disney Channel show about exotic animals and kids. No, I'm not taking you to marsupial rehab. Go to your room. We're out.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.